So, good morning and welcome to Coast Hills. As Kevin said, we are a Jesus-centered community creating gracious space through acts of generous love. If you don't recognize me, my name is Glenn. I'm part of the Coach Hills teaching team. And we're continuing in our Walk with Wisdom series, where we have found ourselves in community, learned to engage our emotional intelligence as part of how God has wired us, trained in mercy to understand wisdom as being sprung from God, and face the awkward moments that all of us try to avoid, conflict resolution. Now, all of this was for the building up of each other and for that introspective moment. So now we move from the crucial introspective work to dreaming about how to make it a tangible lived experience. We move from being to doing as we embrace team. So before we move towards building through team, let's practice statio. And I've said it here a few times, it's an ancient practice that you step into a pause, because sometimes things can hit so quick that they bleed together and you're not sure what you're stepping into, because the last course bleeds into the first part of intro, mixed in with the announcements, and we take away some of our intentional space. So let's pause to remember that movement in the kingdom of God begins in rest, in Sabbath, and that the reality of Psalms 127, 1-2 is that we plan in wisdom, but it's God who ultimately builds. So take 5 seconds, reflect, close your eyes and breathe, and remember that we begin in rest. So as you come back, as we're coming back into that moment so that we can sit intentionally here, and I wanted that moment of intentionality because I'm going to fanboy a little bit today. We're talking about things that I really like, which is the aspect of doing, constructing, building, so we can do something bigger and better and greater. And sometimes method gets conflated with God, and so when people hear method, they think you don't need God. And so I like that pause to say we begin and rest is what Sabbath is, because we move from God to build. And in light of this, of what we're building, what we're moving towards, I want to take a moment to honor our pastoral staff with the recently papered AJ, which makes him official, and the leadership team, because we as a community are intentionally moving towards team-based leadership because of their willingness to gamble on the kingdom, to risk for inclusion. I take on responsibility by joining and growing with the teaching team. However, Kevin and the leadership team are the ones who actually take the weight of the risk, because whether you find me foolish or wise, whether you find me someone to listen to, or can we just get through this quickly, it generally goes to them. I have some conversations, but the weight of the institution is on the leader. So as they share power, as they spread out what it means to be diverse, they're taking a gamble for the potential of what the community can be. If you've read Exodus, which is the text we're going to be sitting in today, you know that as Moses shared power, 3 rebellions came up after the story that we're going to look at today, which was related to other people holding sway in a community. But the thing is that this is always the risk. Shared power is the only way to build God's kingdom rather than our own. Because as we share, as we build, as we invest in others, we have the risk of a rebellion, but the promise of a kingdom that can come. So I just want to say thank you, Coast Hills leaders, for becoming gamblers for God by betting on the potential of this people, because we are stronger together. So let us look to Exodus and the build up to 18, which we're going to do in 30 seconds. Buckle up. This chapter shows us the growing pains, development, and the leading of God go hand in hand. Pain is not separate from God's leading. It actually is part of stepping into a new position. So the narrative movements to chapter 18, you go from slavery and the crying out to the tears of God, causing God to remember and act. Calling Moses so people get rescued, get trapped in the Red Sea for divine intervention, experience war, bitter waters, and then meet up with Jethro at the foot of the mountain of God. 17 chapters pass at a frantic pace, covering 80 years, genocide, war of the gods, of people fleeing through the desert, until suddenly it halts in chapter 18. It brings strong attention that some of the stress, some of the tension, some of the movements in Exodus are directly linked to one chapter that pauses, and it pauses for a day. 80 years and 17 chapters, and one chapter covers a day. And that's the narrator's way of saying, lean in, listen. Throughout the narrative, we find the people, including Moses, struggling to adapt to their new situation. So I'd say, keep the struggle to embrace a new reality in mind as we read Exodus 18. So keep it in mind and try to listen, because whether you get something from me or not, as we listen to the text, we step into the story of God, and the God beyond the text can speak to us through it. So reflect, if nothing else, hold on to what you hear. Now Jethro, the priest of Midian and father-in-law of Moses, heard of everything God has done for Moses, for his people Israel, and how the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt. After Moses had sent away his wife, Zipporah, his father-in-law Jethro received her and her two sons. One son was named Gershom, for Moses said, I have become an alien in a foreign land. The other was named Eliezer, for he said, my father's God was my helper. He saved me from the sword of Pharaoh. Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, together with Moses' sons and wife, came to him in the desert, where he was camped near the mountain of God. Jethro had sent word to him, I, your father-in-law Jethro, am coming to you and your wife and her two sons. So Moses went to the tent. Moses told his father-in-law about everything the Lord had done to Pharaoh and the Egyptians for Israel's sake, about all the hardships they had met along the way, and how the Lord had saved them. Jethro was delighted to hear about all the good things the Lord had done for Israel in rescuing them from the hands of the Egyptians. He said, praise be to the Lord who received you from the hand of the Egyptians and of Pharaoh, and the Lord who is greater than all other gods, for he did this to those who had treated Israel arrogantly. Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, brought a burnt offering and other sacrifices to God. Aaron came with all the elders of Israel to eat bread with Moses' father-in-law in the presence of God. The next day, Moses took his seat to serve as judge for the people. They stood around him from morning till evening. When his father-in-law saw all that Moses was doing for the people, he said, "What is this you are doing for the people? Why do you alone sit as judge while all these people stand around you from morning till evening?" Moses answered, "Because the people come to me to seek God's will. Whenever they have a dispute, it is brought to me, and I decide between the parties and inform them of God's decrees and laws." Moses' father-in-law replied, "What you are doing is not good. You and these people who come to you will only wear yourself out. The work is too heavy for you. You cannot handle it alone. Listen now to me, and I will give you wise advice, and may God be with you. You must be the people's representative before God and bring their disputes to him. Teach them the decrees and laws and show them the way to live, the duties they are to perform. But select capable men from the people who fear God, trustworthy men who hate dishonest gain, and appoint them as officials over thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens. Have them serve as judges for the people at all times. But have them bring every difficult case to you. The simple ones they can decide themselves. That will make your load lighter, because they will share it with you. If you do this, and God so commands, you will be able to stand the strain, and all these people will go home satisfied." Moses listened to his father-in-law and did everything he said. He chose capable men from all Israel and made them leaders of the people, officials over thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens. They served as judges for the people at all times. The difficult cases they brought to Moses, but the simple ones, they decided for themselves. Now, the way we normally do, and I'm sorry, I try to be fancy, but man, I was made for cold weather. This is getting warm. piano guy, you got a jacket now. But we're going to walk through the text. We read for a moment so that we can hear, but now we're going to have a few notes of the text movements. But I want to warn you, these are not the notes for everything in it. I'm intentionally skipping some ideas of the debate of text, because the point is for us to hear something from the story. If you want to enter into more historical critical, let's grab a coffee. But you'll see in 18:1 to 12, the repetitious retelling of deliverance sets the stage. In verse 1, God's rescue echoed outside the community to Jethro, and it takes great care to make sure you understand that Jethro is a priest of a foreign god. Jethro is not a part of Israel, separated, even though his daughter married Moses. But it's the idea that the event, it's shouting out. And then it mentions Moses, because the first four verses are from the narrator's perspective. It's kind of like James Earl Jones in a movie. He sets the stage for you. He brings you in, lets you know what threads you should be following. And in 3 and 4, Moses' children outline the narrative of Exodus. Gershon, for I have been a foreigner in a foreign land. Eliezer, for the God of my fathers has been my help and delivered me from the sword. It's the full story of Exodus in two children's names. So we step into 5, where you shift from the narrator's perspective to bring it back in a little bit closer to Moses. And with Moses, God's deliverance is retold again, and the priest who has heard now becomes a part of a party. So Moses told his father-in-law everything the Lord had done to Pharaoh and the Egyptians for Israel's sake, about all the hardships. It wasn't clean cut. And how the Lord had saved them. The point is the rescue, which gets repeated, because saved is the same word as delivered, is the same word as rescue. So when you go through the passage and you hear those, it's saying, did you hear about the God who acted? He saved, he rescued, he delivered. He brought us out. And Jethro's response in 12 is, he brought a burnt offering and other sacrifices to God. Aaron came with all the elders of Israel to eat a meal in the presence of God. So the first movement in chapter 18 highlights the amazing events of a God who acts, not a passive, distant deity, but one who hears, investigates, and sees. The section is bookended by the retelling of God's rescue from the narrator's voice to the outside nations, and a foreign priest at the end joining the people of God for a party in God's honor and in God's presence. But the joyful economic recap of God's rescue in 1 through 12 causes us to celebrate, because we have a moment of saying, yes, all these things have happened. It's triumphant. It's strong. They're moving. It's all downhill from here. But new beginnings often create new tensions, and we find them waiting for us in verse 13. In 13, the next day, Moses took his seat to serve as judge, which spawns the question in 14 of why do you alone sit as judge? The weight of isolated leadership strains Moses to the point that Jethro sees the negative effect of isolation and leadership in one shift of watching Moses work. One day he sees and says, no. And Jethro's challenging Moses to look up and see these people standing around. Moses defends himself by highlighting his central role. Because in 15 and 14, in the response to why do you sit alone and these people stand around all day, Moses answers, because the people come to me to seek God. When they have a dispute, it is brought to me. I decide between the parties and inform them of God's decree. I'm the middleman, I'm the important one. Everything falls on me. And this highlights something for us. The blessing of stress and pain is that it brings a highlighted or a heightened focus to a broken system. The danger with stress and pain is its abilities to shrink your vision to symptoms rather than causes. The people come to me. And Moses continues in stress. Jethro's solution is hinted at in 18:14's last question, why are you sitting by yourself? But a subtle hint for Moses to develop and mobilize the people falls short of a man under stress to be able to look up so easily. Because the subtle hint of 14 led to the defensive response, which then brings us to Jethro's plain speech. He said, "I was trying to be sweet, but we need to get a little more focused." In 17, he says, "What you are doing is not good." 18, "You and the people will wear out. You will suffer. You will break. This is going to kill you." Then 19 to 23, "Listen to my wisdom," and I'll summarize, "train and release leaders." So notice, Moses would have been witness to Pharaoh's institutional slavery of the Israelites. He would have seen people placed over the tens, the 50s, the hundreds, and thousands. But he saw them as taskmasters, as those who were dedicated to a system of commodity of human. As taskmasters, it's about producing the next brick being made, or whips. But what Moses brings here, because of the wisdom of someone who's not Jewish, which is why in this series, if you haven't noticed, we brought in emotional intelligence, which is something outside of the biblical canon. You know why? Just like Moses, we can build a stronger, better community by the wisdom that is outside of us at times. Because you are human, and the study of emotions is a human response to the moment. In this, Moses assigned judges to facilitate community restoration. He said, "You guys handle your present, sit with it." This shapes the kind of leaders we train and release. So the narrative ends with Moses obeying the wisdom from a foreign priest. Which brings us to point one. Growing pains are unavoidable. You can live in it or grow through it. It's all in how you respond. Like Moses in 18, 13 to 16, our stress can narrow our vision. In that, in places where you hold some influence, whether it's the family, whether it's your job, whether it's just in relationships, whether it's life group, under stress, you won't look up until you have a voice of Jethro. And so it is story time, my favorite part. And my story is titled, "Toothache, Stubborn Short-Sightedness, and Yes, Brittany Was Right." So last week, before my classes, I started to get some pain here. I didn't know what it was, but given the way I was raised in the States where you don't go to doctors, I thought, let's walk it off. And it kept growing to where I went into a meeting that day, and it started to be, do you know where you get that fracture in your bone, you can feel the pulse of your heart, but in the wrong spot? It started to do that to where my friend asked, like, "Are you tracking with me? Because all you keep doing is this." And I was like, "Oh, it'll be fine. Hurts a little." It's like, okay, I ignore it until the next day, where it goes from triggering a pain here to circling up around my jaw, and I didn't know it was connected, but apparently there's a nerve here too that caused a tooth to throb. Like, this is getting excessive. I'm in an intensive, so I have lectures from 9 in the morning to 5 in the afternoon. It turns out, when your whole head pulses from your heartbeat, you can't pay attention. And so I was sitting there in class, rubbing my jaw, walking around, telling the teachers, it's okay, I'm tracking, it's cool. Making a fool of myself to where I finally call my dentist. And I get a hold of the dentist, say, "I'm going to die." And they say, "Well, that's terrible. We can see you next Wednesday." I'm like, got it. I soldier on for 1 week and we're good. The next day I go to work and I discovered in class that if you drink water and swish it around, it magically started to make the pain go away a little bit. I think I drank a gallon of water at work because I was so fixated on pain removal. I was so fixated on the throbbing in my jaw that I wasn't too concerned with other things, not even making my sales because I lost a few of them, because it turns out if you walk away every 30 seconds to pee, then come back with a full bottle of water, it's really awkward. Brittany knew I didn't sleep well, so she came in. She brought a latte. I hadn't connected that the coldness of the water, not the swishing of the water, is what did the pain reduction. So I thank her for her sweetness and consideration. I take a drink and actually fall to the floor, catching myself on the counter, almost crumbling, run towards my bottle of water, slamming the thing down. And in the middle of the sales floor, I grab it going, and everyone stares. And Brittany's like, "Oh, it's this much pain? Did you call your dentist? Like, of course I called my dentist. What are you thinking? So what'd they say? Like, next week. She's like, you doubled over in pain and almost threw up. Did you call more than one dentist? You know the scene in Zoolander, if you're old enough to have seen the movie, where they say the files are in the computer, and he looks up and goes, in the computer? That was me, because I just like stared at Brittany and said, dumbfounded, call more than one dentist? Because I was so fixated on, there was one cure, one thing, my pain hurt, this was it. Becoming fixated on the pain, I couldn't look up to see the obvious solution. It took Britt's question to cause me to look up. Then, because she knows I'm slow at catching on, she did not pull Jethro's move and said, now you must do for yourself. She walked outside the store, made phone calls, and came in and said, honey, you're going to a dentist in 40 minutes. I'm like, wow, I did 72 hours of mind-numbing pain because I didn't do 3 phone calls. Wisdom. So that brings us to point 2A. If you're following along in the notes, just in case you didn't know, on the back, there's fill in the blank. If you'd like to fill in the blank, please do. So point 2A, Jethro speaks to leaders and point people. Recognize, resource, and release people's potential. And if you're a leader, you're not sure how to do this, and if you're part of where Coast Hills is going, we're going through DCAT, doing church as a team. Paul mentioned him when he talked about doing soap journaling. That conference he went to is a doing church as a team conference. It's a good, easy book to enter that would allow you to engage some with how can we imagine team building. And in DCAT, our Jethro, as I like to call him, because he's a Hawaiian minister from another country, so he traveled to us and he goes back. Although I think he's around the mountain of God and we left it, because come on, Hawaii. So in DCAT, our Jethro, Wayne Cadero, offers us a lens to see the potential standing around us. Each of us has been given unique gifts, capabilities, and passions which enable us to excel in certain activities. If we concentrate on pointing out each other's weaknesses, we may seem spiritual or vigilant, but we won't be fruitful or helpful. Everybody is a 10 somewhere. So like Moses Jethro, Wayne points to the unrealized potential of the people standing around and says these people realizing their 10 and building the kingdom through it is where the power of the movement is. That is the leadership drive behind the recognize, resource, and release. Because within recognize, we see in verse 4 that Jethro says, why do you alone sit as judge while all these people stand around? Moses' pain, Moses' stress, his anxiety in this moment of new situations narrowed his vision. He had to look again at the people he has seen every day for months. These weren't new people. It wasn't a new experience of a new community. Jethro said, look up at who's around you. To recognize the strength already surrounding him. What do you see when you look around? Do you see shortcomings or potential? Do you see weakness or the possibilities of someone 10-ness coming out and being dynamic, passionate? And that's the call to the leaders. Whatever you run, and this is whether it's at your house on how you deal with your children, to if you're running a ministry, a life group, when you see people, are they needs or potential? When you invest in them, what you recognize, are you recognizing the God-given beauty and strength? That in early things, it's strength development. If you like to do some of the Clifton style, there's raw potential that has to be developed into a strength. Are you noticing the raw potential where their tenderness is? Resource it. And 19 and 20, Jethro doesn't just say, throw it out. He says, you must be the people's representative. Teach them. So once you see, take the time to nurture it. Don't just name it, walk along with it. Because this sets up people for success. When you see raw talent, when you see ability, the only reason I've even stayed around the church and delve into scripture is because I've had people who saw a young, brash, arrogant, outspoken kid and said, there's something there. If you just calm it down a bit, I'd love to work with you. And I didn't. They sat with me forever. This is the calm version of me. And so, but that's the thing. And you resource them to release them. Verse 21 then moves to the select capable men who fear God, trustworthy, who hate dishonest gain. Don't look for the shady mover, not the manipulator, not the one who take a shaking hand and then say, it's all good. So take the ones who are honest, that fear God. Have them serve as judges for the people, not on Tuesdays, not once in a while, all day, all times. Releasing isn't telling or isn't letting go and walking away. It's not, fly bird, I hope you learned. It's walking with, because releasing isn't letting go and walking away. It is giving people space to own their 10 while walking with them. Releasing is using wisdom to see people's 10-ness can handle, because some were placed over 1,000, some were 100, some were 50, some were 10. You have similar passions, you all take the same part of the field. This will also be affected by your life stage, because if you have 5 children under 7, I imagine the time you need to fully express your 10-ness might be limited. If you're working 90 hours a week, the time you need to step into full 10-ness might be limited. So maybe your 10-ness steps over 10 people. But if you're at a place in life where you have energy, passion, and drive, maybe with training and resourcing, you can step over 1,000. Because what we want to see is a people on fire stepping into their 10-ness in such a way that it dramatically and dynamically impacts what we do. So moving people from recognition to release is an intentional process. If I said, are you recognizing, resourcing, and releasing, and you do not have a single name that pops up in your mind, you might not be doing it. If I said, recognize, resource, release, everybody pops up in your mind, it's an intentional process. If every person you have contact to, you're like, yeah, I'm hitting this out of the park, you're probably not doing it. It's an intentional engagement with people. Which brings us to point 2B. And this is how I keep it a 3-point sermon. I have points A and B, so we stay within the field and I feel better about it. Our Jethro speaks to those standing around Moses. Discover your 10-ness through trial and error, then grow where you're planted. A tool for discovering your 10-ness that I'd recommend to you is living your strengths. The people who wrote it are Christian psychologists who believe that highlighting your strength is more important than identifying your weakness, because as you grow in strength, you're more passionate and involved. However, since today is the wisdom of DCAT, the quotes you're about to hear are not from that book. Within DCAT, it says a similar thing. Your passion is the area or arena where you feel most motivated to use your gift. Knowing your spiritual gift will answer the what question. So if you like teaching, you're going to say, maybe I want to preach, maybe I want to lead a life group, maybe I want to be a mentor at a school for kids not getting math. But you know the what. Knowing your passion will answer the where question. Like I said, maybe you like to teach, but your passion is youth and youth development, so you volunteer at a Big Brother, Big Sister program to help people with math, to help people solve life. Because the passion directs the talent. And he goes on to say, and since I worked for Wayne Cadero, like I can say, he told us this one a lot. Be patient. You may not be able to find your fit until 2 or 3 other pieces of your life fall into place. It usually takes several tries in order to find the right fit. Remember, everyone is a 10 somewhere. So in that idea, I'd say that in my experience, I have grown best within community, but I've been given the privilege of gracious space to allow myself to mess things up. I'll skip one of the stories because I'm running a little bit long. So we'll go to Molokai, and one of the people that allowed me. Molokai is a little island off of Oahu. And when I first got brought into ministry around New Hope, I was brought into the junior high youth ministry, 6th to 8th graders. And I discovered that is not my 10. I don't have the temperament. Because I'm a bit forward, I'm a bit aggressive. They gave me the knuckleheads, the one who talked back. And God, in divine providence and wisdom, said what Glenn needs is a child this big who is him. And he never passed up a time to crack a joke. Even when a kid was in the middle of like a tearful confession, here's how God's speaking to me, boom, joke, ruined the whole thing. And there was 3 days into the 24-hour time with 6th to 8th graders, I didn't get coffee in the morning because trying to get them out of our bunks meant I missed breakfast. I didn't get to escape to get coffee because I had things to do in the afternoon. So we're hitting about 6 o'clock, and Glenn's not caffeinated, and the child once again mouths off. And before I thought, no, Glenn, this is a youth camp, I grabbed him by the shirt and put him up against the wall and said, uncle, because if you're older than anyone, you're an uncle in Hawaii. I was like, uncle hasn't had coffee. You want to stop. And then I looked up, and every kid there's eyes were this big, mouth dropped, going, I was like, overstepped? Sorry. So go ahead, please share how you experienced God's love. But then I transitioned into the high school, and the high school kids I understood a little better. I understood the special nature of a 16-year-old falling out of his wheelchair because he was trying to do a handstand because a beautiful girl walked by him. Rather than saying hi with his knee bandaged from surgery, he did a handstand and fell onto concrete. That kind of specialness I know. But with them, I got to step into part of the program to where we developed a youth group, and I found some of my fit. You know why? I got to work with them to create the teaching team, teach them how to work through scripture, help them walk through the process, and I can count myself proud because I can say Scotty, Kai, Koa, Garrett Mizunaka, Logan, and about 5 others went to seminary because they said the training we did with them inspired them that the Bible could be more than they knew, so they need to find out. 3 of them are working in the church doing amazing things with ministry because we were able to train, because when you step into your tennis, you'll get stories being able to look back and say it was worth it. Because I've stepped into some of the things that I love, that I'm passionate about. I get to look back and name churches, name people, and name events where I say, the sacrifice has been worth it. Because I found my stride, and I can see lives impacted. It's not because I'm so amazing. It's because I found something that I'm passionate about. And when you're passionate, you're dedicated. And when you're dedicated, you have the energy to affect people. And that's what we want. So if you're not a point person right now, if you're sitting around saying, I don't really know what my talent is, I don't know my fit, grab the resource. Take that moment of reflection to say, what can I step into? And remember, I put a kid by the collar of his shirt up against a wall to tell him he was annoying. You get to have gracious space for trial and error. I was talked to but not kicked out at that point because they said that's not good conflict resolution. And so we're going to move into point 3. Places to develop your tenderness here. It can be difficult to know how to start. That being said, I thought I would offer a few places with enough gracious space for trial and error here. Places to discover how your tenderness can come to life, and not just come to life, but affect other people. If you enjoy setting things up, you don't like to be in front, but you like creating space for other people to come into, I would say join the setup team. Because if we had 2 groups of 3 to 4 people that said we could build community together this way, you could alternate weekends, and you're talking about 2.5 hours a month to where you can step in and use your talent to set space so other people can come in and experience grace. It's not flashy, it's not glamorous, and half the time people will notice only when you got the chairs wrong. I was on setup team for years. However, without it, we don't get to come in and experience community. If you're passionate about helping people process and talk to discover where they're at, talk to Ajay. We have youth that need mentors. Because think in your own lives, where are you now is probably directly related to some people in your life who took time to pause, took 4 hours a week to say, your life is valuable, I want to see it take the next step. Or talk to Kevin. If, like me, you dealt with some things and realize it's not your best fit, but you're still invested in people, remember, gifting is the what, passion is the where. Shadow somebody in the life group. Say, how could I run one? How can I help with one? How can I facilitate? Or, if you like expressing Jesus through creative art or artistic means, then I'd love to talk with you, because what I would like to see here, this is not my tenderness, but I love developing things, is creating a creative group that is not just a sermon, it's not just a lecture in music, although I love both those things, but we have more voices, and what the voices will sound like will be spoken word. It will be a song special if that's where your passion is. It'll be art being up here, so we have our own iconography that when you look, because not everybody connects to lectures. Not everybody connects to music. I know some people who sit before iconography, which is actually just religious symbols, just in case that word's not common. But religious symbols and paintings, and God speaks to them. We want that here, because adding more voices isn't about just adding more speakers. It's creating more avenues that your tenderness can thrive in such a way that more people connect. So I'm excited to see the possibilities surrounding us, and I know that finding our tens would fundamentally change how we do church as a team. So in closing, invite AJ up and say, DCAT is exciting to me because we, not I, are a Jesus-centered community creating gracious space so that people can experience grace drawing them towards Jesus. Becoming a Jesus-centered community is not about sermons and music, but it includes these things. It is the combined effect of every person finding their tenderness so that they can extend a gracious space by using your tenderness to add value to the community and build it up. Every person that welcomed people coming in the front doors, every person that was a part of the setup team, every hand that touched a chair to create the space we walked into, we're not just doing menial tasks that we said we have to accomplish something. They were using acts of love to extend grace, because you welcome in and you show people. They are setting up avenues for a gracious space, along with every musician and preacher, every Sunday school and youth mentor extends grace to draw people Christward. So today, Soup Sunday, you're not just having lunch together because you're not going to go to a restaurant. Each kitchen that prepared food for us today is serving grace one bowl at a time so that people can experience a Jesus-centered community together around a shared table. Find your fit. Grow together so that we can expand grace because we are stronger together.